Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fall of the Reaper by Miranda Honfler and Nicolette Andrews, narrated by Caitlin Davies. I feel the nights stretching away, thousands long behind the days, till they reach the darkness where all of me is ancestor. Annie Finch, Samhain. Chapter 1. Dark whispers hissed secrets, slithering up Brigida's arm and to her ear like serpents. "There is another," they whispered. "Another has arrived." Yet another. With a grimace, she set aside the pestle and bagged the red raspberry leaf, lemon balm, and chamomile tea for her latest patient, then removed her apron and rolled down her sleeves. The black crescent mark on her palm throbbed, its darkness and whispers seeping from her skin like smoke. She curled a fist, a tight one, and strode across Anita's small cottage to her altar, where the scythe of the mother rested on its two hooks. With a frustrated huff, she retrieved it. Standing there before the altar, she listened, really listened, tightening her grip on the scythe's snath, closing her eyes. "Speak to me." Maybe this time she would feel something. Anything. But in her hand, there was nothing but dead wood and silence. The voices of Anita's ancestors had not spoken to her. Not yet. But she hadn't given up hope. Maybe one more demon tamed would be enough. Maybe today she would calm the forest back to slumbering at last. Outside, the sun had risen just beyond the tree line, and long shadows wove over the clearing between the cottage and the forest. Her patient would be here at midday, so she'd need to make this quick. Crouched in the shade, Matoha waited for her, his red eyes gleaming. His body was goat-like, but that was where any semblance of natural appearance ended. He had a ridge of spiky fur down his spine, bladed claw-like legs, and a long black tail, shifting ruminatively. He was always waiting, always watching her. As she approached the oaks, he rose to his full height, his menacing long horns scraping against low-hanging branches. "Back again?" she asked him. Matoha opened his mouth, baring rows of pointed teeth in a fearsome grin.
"We have a new arrival," he spoke into her mind.
"So I've heard." She rested her hand against the trunk of a nearby oak, closing her eyes as she tried to listen for the voices of the wood, but all she could hear was the hiss of demons, those that watched from the shadows, those that never quite left her for long.
"I can take you to it,"
Matoha prompted. It was tempting to let him take the lead, guide her to the demon, but if she was ever going to reconnect with the forest, to truly heal it, she had to do this herself. Hefting up her scythe, she gave a short shake of her head before venturing into the forest. Thank Mokosa, Mama had taught her how to track, and recent spring showers had left the ground muddy. Deep imprints in the mud led to the heart of the forest, and she followed them, Matoha accompanying her at a distance. The canopy of trees had only just begun to fill out, and shafts of light pierced through, illuminating the soft forest floor where fresh green stalks of ferns poked through dark soil. Months had passed since she'd made her home here, and although she'd defeated every demon that had arrived on these lands, they never stopped, and the forest was still restless. She might not be able to hear its voice, but she could feel it as the hairs on the back of her neck stood on end. A tree branch snapped behind her. She spun. A bristly, thick-horned creature threw its head back, roaring, long claws and a cow's tail. "Alihi," it rushed toward her. Her hand fumbled for the vial of lake water around her neck, but the words of the incantation dried on her tongue. She couldn't use the wrath of the blood. Leaping out of the way, she rolled into the new ferns. The Lihi skidded to a stop and turned, clawing at the ground, ready to charge once more. This was no lone little panic, but a true danger. And she'd made a foolish mistake, relying on instinct. The crescent mark on her palm throbbed, the faintest trail of darkness seeping from it. She held up her hand, summoning the power within the mark. Darkness billowed out, like thick black smoke spreading outward and toward the Lihi. As it reared up, looming over her, their eyes met. With flared nostrils, it inhaled the black smoke and froze in place. It was hers to command now. As she held her hand up, it awaited her command, like a part of her, and with a downward motion, it lay down on the ground, eyes trained on her.
"That was close," Matoha remarked.
She ignored his commentary. It was never helpful. Matoha had to know how to soothe the forest. Why else had he been hovering around her for weeks? But he had refused to answer her, despite numerous attempts to extract answers. She'd read Anita's grimoire from cover to cover, given numerous offerings to demons and to Holy Mokosa, but no matter what she did, her water powers wouldn't return. Matoha raised his head, goat ears angling back and forth. The Lihi, too, lifted its head back in the direction of the cottage.
"It's a human,"
its rumble of a voice announced in her head.
"A human. A human has arrived. A human's come to your domain."
She balled her marked hand into a fist again. "It's not my domain," she wanted to scream back. But it never changed their minds. The demons understood only one thing, power. But their warnings, that a human was here, meant that her patient, Jadwiga, had likely come to retrieve her morning sickness tea. Just in time, too. The witchlands were cleansed of chaotic demons, something all the more important with an expectant mother traveling to her cottage.
"I await your call,"
the Lihi said, before it dissipated into the forest, a phantom once more. Matoha pranced ahead of her, leaping through the forest, avoiding the occasional spots of sunlight. It wasn't like him to stick around after a demon had been subdued. Was something amiss at the cottage? Hastening her step, she arrived at the forest edge. Instead of finding Jadwiga, as she expected, a man with golden hair waited at the door. Wrapped in a well-tailored and luxurious poppy-red jacket and gleaming brown boots, he cut a lean but strong figure. "Caspian?" He turned, and what she'd mistaken as golden hair beneath the bright afternoon sun was in fact a darker blonde. Not Caspian. And not Jadwiga either, but her husband, Nikodem, the future lord of Granat. Shading his hands against the sun, he stared in her direction. Had something happened to Jadwiga? Had she gone into labor early? It was unusual for a first pregnancy, but not unheard of.
"There is only one reason a man comes to a witch's cottage, and you still have no successor,"
Matoha remarked. Snapping her gaze in Matoha's direction, she flushed at the insinuation. "You dare, goat demon?" An entertained chuckle lilted to the corners of her mind, echoing. He'd never attacked her, nor anyone, and didn't give an aura of ill intent, so she'd never tried to tame him. Although now, it was tempting. Nikodem was a married man, and his wife was her patient, and as Matoha well knew, there would be no successor for her. These were not her witchlands, and until she redeemed herself in the eyes of Mokosa, and for herself, there was no room in her heart for anyone else. After Caspian, she wasn't sure she even wanted anyone else. That had gone about as swimmingly as a rock in the Skava River. She left Matoha at the edge of the forest and jogged over to greet Nikodem. "What brings you here? Is Jadwiga well?" His mouth dropped open, but he quickly closed it.
"Yes, she's well."
If Jadwiga wasn't ill, then perhaps this was just a visit? Nikodem and his sister Ursula came from time to time to share news and keep her company. They didn't say as much, but their regularity had washed away any doubt. Besides, it would be rude not to serve tea now, when he'd come all this way. "Will you come in while I finish Jadwiga's morning sickness herbs?" He nodded his head in response. She led him inside, offered him a plate of rabbit sausage and freshly baked bread, and put the kettle on the fire, the same way Mamusha had always done. The feeling of homesickness was like a punch to the gut, strong but quickly stifled, to reflect on when she was alone.
While the water started to boil, she cleared the table of her mortar and pestle, the herbs and the other things she had prepared for Jadwiga. She put them into a jar to give to Nikodem. Jadwiga's constant morning sickness, even this late in the pregnancy, worried her. She could hardly keep anything down, and when the baby came, she would need her strength. Was Jadwiga too tired to make the journey herself? Brigida asked as she worked. It would not be entirely surprising, given the lateness of her pregnancy. A good husband like Nikodem would gladly make the trip, but she hoped it wasn't something more serious.
No. Nikodem sat at the table, hands folded in front of him as he surveyed the cottage.
The kettle started to whistle, and Brigida filled a cup and set one before him. He looked deeply into it as the tendrils of steam rose, a slight frown on his brow. He was a man of few words, and when he visited, he usually just brought some provisions from town, did some work on their cottage or the barn, and listened to her talk. But he'd only just come 2 days ago. Surely he hadn't come all this way again so soon just to drink tea with her. "Something on your mind?" she prompted gently.
"There is," he sighed, his shoulders tight and raised toward his neck.
"If there is something wrong with Jadwiga, tell me straight away. I can go to her if necessary." He shook his head.
"She is well."
"Then what's troubling you?"
Clearly something was.
He cleared his throat.
"I came because I need your help."
She drummed her fingers on the table, trying to hide her curiosity. Nikodem met her eyes and held her gaze as grave as a ghost.
"A man calling himself the Prophet of Velis has arrived, and is recruiting people to join the cult of Velis."
Her fingers froze in their drumming. The cult was back? I thought you and your sister chased the cult out of Granat.
"We did, but he has an ally here, a vassal of my father's, who is protecting him. A wealthy man is housing him. We cannot risk physically removing him without endangering the people of Granat. This vassal would use our intervention as an excuse to start a war with my father."
The crescent on her palm throbbed. The last time she'd gone up against the cult of Velis, she'd still had Mokosa's favor, and even that hadn't been enough. It had been the black mark that had killed them. She couldn't risk it. Not again. "I'm sorry, but I can't help you." She stood, pushed in her chair, and stepped behind it. Nikodem stood as well.
"You have the power to stop them. The mark of Velis."
He gestured toward her palm. She concealed the mark with her other hand. "I know how the cult of Velis works. They use women to defend themselves against witches. I won't hurt a woman. It goes against everything I believe in." He took a slow step forward, reaching out to touch her arm, then let his hand fall.
"I would not ask you if we were not desperate."
Brigida regarded him with caution and curiosity, her fingers curled over the cursed mark. Normally solemn and quiet, he had to be truly afraid of the Prophet of Velis to make such an emotional appeal to her. Perhaps there was a way she could defeat this Prophet of Velis that didn't involve killing? After all, she'd found ways to soothe the forest without Mokosa's favor. The people of Granat knew her, and they were starting to trust her. Maybe she could find a way to turn their feelings against this prophet before it was too late, before all turned to violence. They needed a time and place for the truth to defeat this so-called prophet. She inhaled deeply. "I won't harm any women, but I will help you. I think I know just how." Chapter 2. The sun beat down on Caspian from the bright, cloudless sky. He pulled at his collar as sweat dripped down his brow, blurring into his eyes. The effigy of Marzana, crafted from bundles of dried twigs and wearing an old cornflower blue dress of Mama's, looked nothing like the goddess of winter he'd seen depicted in tapestries. As a boy, the same effigy had scared him when he'd stood here with Tata. But now his concerns didn't brush fear of the divine so much as the mundane. The morning was wearing on, and only half the village had arrived.
"Why don't we wait a little longer?" Mama whispered.
"Not a very good turnout," Striek remarked, shaking his head.
He had stayed longer than they'd anticipated. Caspian had assumed his uncle would move on to his next destination with the first melt, perhaps never to be seen again. But even now he showed no signs of leaving. He'd become a fixture, a gruff, sardonic one. Peasants shuffled their feet, few looking toward him, Mama or Striak. This year's drowning of Marzana was a more subdued affair than most. Usually the return of spring brought with it joy and laughter, but unlike years past, where Tata had overseen the ritual, the peasants seemed more dispirited than usual. Small wonder. His rulership felt like when he'd worn Tata's boots as a boy, big and hard to fill, and at any moment presaging a fall. But just as he had grown into Tata's boots, he would grow into his new role as well. With time, he felt confident the people would come to love and respect him. The loss of Tata and many others had cast a long shadow over the village. They were in need of healing, a return to hope and goodness. Mama had said over and over that his first ritual would set the tone of his rule. What that tone was, he had spent much time debating. Tata had ruled with an iron fist. Caspian had been practicing what he would say for days, and trying to emulate Tata's tone and delivery, but the words still stumbled on his tongue, like his boyish feet had in those two big boots. He'd seen Tata perform it every year, for as long as he could remember, but standing here, it was as if all those memories were just too far beyond his grasp, and he was left staring blankly. Mama nudged him gently.
"Perhaps we should get started after all?" she asked brightly.
Was he that transparent? Blinking away his thoughts with a sigh, he cleared his throat and took a step forward. Maybe trying to act like Tata wasn't the best course of action. He should be more himself.
"Let us begin." He clapped his hands together, stalling for time. "The long winter has passed, and now we welcome the rebirth of spring."
He gestured toward the effigy of Marzana. Someone coughed, but otherwise there was silence. They stared at him, their reactions more subdued than he would have hoped. But no matter, best to just carry on with the ceremony. It would get better with time. It was only his first, after all. Caspian gestured to Striak, who took his cue, taking up the torch. He tossed it at the effigy, and soaked in oil, it caught fire almost immediately. As the flames burst to life, Caspian leaped backward, evading a plume of fire. The peasants gave excited gasps as it burned. Now that they were in the rhythm of things, it felt more natural. And after a few minutes, the fire had faded enough that he could pick up the effigy and carry it. As he got close, the flames licked toward his face, and he had to resist the urge to shield himself from the fire. Tata had always carried the burning effigy without hesitation, leading the people of the village through the ritual. Before he could second-guess himself, he grasped the unburnt bottom half and hoisted it up into the air, then took a step toward the Skava River, where it would be tossed. Mama and Striak fell into place behind him as he led the procession down the winding dirt road from the manor and to the river, which cut through their village. As they walked, the villagers began to sing. "Marzana, Marzana, swim across the seas. Let flowers bloom and fields turn green." As their procession made its way through the village, shadows stretched on the ground in front of him, and for a moment, it was as if he and Tata were walking side by side. A few more peasants joined their procession, and the more that joined, the livelier they became, their song more joyful in the spirit of the spring celebration. This was the tone he wanted to set for his rule, one of celebration and community. They reached the banks of the river, near to bursting as the winter snow had melted and filled it with cold, clear water. The Skava gurgled happily, and as he stood at its banks, he remembered Tata standing in this place just a year ago. He'd been so healthy and strong. Who would have thought that in the next year, he would be gone? But there was no more time for grieving, and the wheel of time moved ever forward. He couldn't continue to look back, only forward. He was the leader now, as Tata had wished, and the village was in his care. To the gods who bore witness, Let this be his offering that he would be a good ruler, a fair ruler.
Now we lay to rest the remnants of winter. Let our crops be plentiful, and our calves and lambs healthy. So I pray to the gods above,
Caspian said, willing it to truth with every fiber of his being. The villagers' song carried on the wind as they linked hands along the riverbank. Seeing them united this way made his heart swell. He tossed the effigy into the water. The flames were extinguished, and the current swept it out of sight. With it, he washed away his past. It was time to start over fresh, and although he knew it was best to let it all go, he couldn't escape the feeling of longing for what he was leaving behind. With the ceremony over, Caspian turned to the peasants.
Let us celebrate the new birth of spring.
A feast has been prepared at the manor.
The peasants gave a cheer, and their procession looped back toward the manor house, everyone chattering among themselves. The change in their reaction was reassuring. Although there might be growing pains, together they could build a bright future. He was confident of that, but still he lingered behind across the river. Together. The mad wood was beginning to come alive once more, fresh green buds ready to unfurl. Was it springtime where Brigida was now? Was she walking amongst the trees, communing with nature free and unburdened? The forest offered no answer. He likely would never know. Like the effigy of Marzana, their time together had been swept away and would never return. And yet what memories remained wouldn't depart with the current. He could say they haunted him. But could a man ever be haunted by something he loved so much? Perhaps enchanted. Or more aptly, bewitched. He shook his head, hoping to clear it, and took a deep breath before he turned his back on the forest and joined his people. One farmer lagged behind, watching him approach. He was a grizzled old man with white hair and a back starting to bend from years tilling the soil. The frown was not a good sign. Caspian braced himself.
My lord, the farmer said, bobbing his head to Caspian. I'm sorry to trouble you, but there's a catastrophe. Several farms have been taken by the blight.
The blight. The word sent a chill down his spine. The spring planting had started early this year, as the snow had receded earlier than years past, and the farmers had anticipated a bountiful harvest. But a blight, if left unchecked, could sweep through the entire community and leave many starving and hungry. Mama and Striak would know what to do, how to handle a situation like this. If this was his new start, then he needed to take responsibility. The two of them were heading back to the manor, but he was still here, and he was responsible. Show me. Caspian gripped the farmer's shoulder in what he hoped would be seen as authoritative but kind, and motioned toward the fields. They hurried down the road, past farmlands with rows upon rows of neat lines of wheat. Small green leaves burst through the fertile soil and swayed in the wind. But as they approached the farmer's land, the field was covered in sickly dead plants, leaves curling inward. Caspian knelt down and grasped the leaf, which broke off from the stem. What could have caused this?
That's not all, my lord. My neighbors to the west have been affected as well.
The farmer wrung his hat in his hands. More? If this was widespread, it could cause a panic. Taking the farmer's lead, he visited two more farms, each of them with similar crops dying before they'd ever had a chance to bloom. But what was most unusual was that whatever had caused this blight, it was nothing he'd ever seen before. There was no scale, no signs of disease, just crops that had withered for no apparent reason. The farmer yelped and pointed toward the forest.
What is that?
A shadowy figure moved among the trees, and Caspian reached for the sword at his belt. An easiness settled in his chest. It couldn't be one of the demons, could it? The figure emerged. It wasn't a demon at all, but Stefan, who approached with a sheepish wave, his rough-spun work shirt and breeches disheveled.
What is he doing in the mad wood?
The farmer pointed an accusatory finger at Stefan. A very good question, and one he himself wanted to know the answer to.
albeit less desperately than the farmer, from what he could tell.
"Where have you been?"
Caspian asked him. Stefan shrugged. "A horse got loose and ran into the mad wood. I chased after it, but when I did, I got turned around."
A likely story, especially with no horse at his side.
Caspian shook his head. Only Stefan would be so reckless as to venture into the mad wood alone. He hadn't set foot there since Brigida had left. His chest and shoulders tightened. That painful ache of loss surging through him as he recalled her ferocity, beauty, and tenacity. But best not to think about that right now. Best not to think of the woman he'd loved and lost. Best not to think of the most stunning woman he had ever beheld.
"I've seen you going in and out of the mad wood before."
The farmer narrowed his eyes, looking at Stefan. The farmer's rough voice jarred Caspian from the tumultuous hold of his thoughts. Stefan pointed at his own chest. "Me? Why would I go into the mad wood? There are plenty of other places I'd rather go. You must be mistaken." Stefan laughed off the notion with a dismissive wave, his expression incredulous. He trusted Stefan, but this disappearing act had become more common lately, even during the ceremony today. But Stefan would tell him why he was going into the forest when he was ready. And maybe when a terrified farmer wasn't pointing a trembling, accusatory finger at him. For now, he needed to redirect the farmer's attention. "Are there any other farms affected?
Norbert." The farmer looked away from Stefan. "Several. I can show you if you want, my lord."
He would be missing out on the feast at the manor, but investigating the blight was more important than anything else. "Yes, let's go." Together they visited farm after farm. By the eighth, his eyes were hurting, but he was still no closer to the cause of the blight. Many farms had been affected, but thank Perun, not all the farms in the region seemed to have been hit. Those that were had only one thing in common. They were all bordering the Mad Wood. What could it mean? As the latest farmer, an elderly, rotund man named Vatsek, grumbled nearby, Caspian rubbed his temples and looked to the forest. Was it possible something had come from there to affect the crops?
"Did you see anything in there?" he asked Stefan.
"Trees?" Stefan offered, and Caspian rolled his eyes.
"What are you going to do, my lord?"
Norbert asked.
"We will do everything we can to ensure you and your family are taken care of," Caspian said.
Vatsek stomped up to them.
"Why would we trust you? This damned blight is all your fault."
"Vatsek, think clearly," Norbert said to him. "This is Wukash's son, whose face you've seen covered in mud playing with our children. The blight is terrible, but it's not a man's fault. It's bad luck."
Vatsek scoffed angrily, waving Norbert away.
"You think Lord Caspian can what? Wave a hand and kill your crops?"
Stefan asked, eyebrows raised.
"I assure you, I have no control over plants,"
Caspian added, doing his best to keep the dryness from his voice. Accusations like this were truly ridiculous, but he wouldn't improve his reputation by mocking his people. The least he could do was to treat them with respect, whether for the sake of affection or order, and hope to be repaid in kind.
"You should have paid for your crimes. That innocent girl died at your hands, and now Mokosa has forsaken us all."
The man jutted a finger at Caspian. Caspian's eyes were wide as he stared at the man. The whispers had followed him since Roxana's death, but he thought they were just that. Rumors. Rumors followed rulers. It was one of the unfortunate aspects of his duty. But never before had someone had the audacity to say that to his face.
"That's enough," Stefan grumbled, rolling up his sleeves as he approached Vatsek. But Caspian held up a hand to stop him.
"I would have never harmed Roxana. The real killer was punished, as you well know," Caspian replied, squaring his shoulders. Stefan's support was always welcome, but his temper was shorter than it had ever been.
"If it really had been Yulian, this wouldn't be happening,"
Vatsek snarled, his jowls jiggling.
"It was Yulian, you fool,"
Stefan remarked, his brow creased.
I saw it myself. He tried to kill the witch because she figured out it was him. The Rusalki let Caspian go.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?